Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, a local business partners with a technical school to fill a need. But up front, diabetes mellitus is a term for a group of disorders that cause elevated blood sugar, glucose levels in the body. When you eat, your body breaks down carbohydrates into glucose. This triggers the pancreas to release a hormone called insulin, which acts as a key that allows glucose to enter the cells from the blood. If your body doesn't produce enough insulin to effectively manage glucose, it can't function or perform properly. Up until about 100 years ago, diabetes was often deadly. In 1921, a group of Canadian scientists discovered how to make insulin, which was a game changer. Today, the CDC estimates 1.6 million Americans live with type 1 diabetes and another 80 to 90 million with type 2 or prediabetes. Joining us on today's program is Dr. Mark Schuta. He's medical director of the Penn Rodabaugh Diabetes Center at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman Center for Advanced Medicine. Dr. Schuta, welcome to the program. I'm going to start with the basic question. I provided some context there, but how would you describe, in layman's terms, what diabetes is?
So thanks, Scott. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning. So diabetes is really a relative starvation state and actually malnutrition if not well controlled. So you described it very well that we need insulin as the major hormone to help us transport fuel into our cells for energy. And that maintains our weight and, sort of keeps us going. The young people who get type 1 diabetes don't make any insulin whatsoever. And Banting and Best, the Canadians who isolated insulin and first gave it to people who with type 1 diabetes, saved their lives.
So you mentioned type 1 diabetes. Want you to describe the different types of diabetes. There's type 1, type 2, some other, I use the term pre-diabetes. What is the difference between these types of diabetes?
Well, let's start with type 2 diabetes, which is actually the more common form of diabetes in the world today. And it's actually, we talk about the pandemic that we're having with COVID. Type 2 diabetes is a global pandemic as well. And a lot of it is due to the increase in obesity, the automated society that we live in. And what it is a genetic sort of predisposition to this disease, where either you don't make enough insulin to keep up with demand, or the insulin that you make doesn't work properly. And that's called insulin resistance. So a lot of patients who have this, it's not something that happens acutely. It's a gradual, slow progression. The sad thing about it is we have 34 million Americans who have type 2 diabetes today, and 7 to 8 million of them are not even aware that they have it, because they may have some mild symptoms that are insidious, slow in onset. And so they don't really, and they sort of adapt to that, right? And the typical symptoms that they'll have are fatigue, they're urinating a little too much, maybe little cuts and bruises and wounds that they have don't heal very well. They feel very thirsty, and really they have a low energy. And the thing that they'll present with often when we see them in the emergency room with new onset type 2 diabetes is that they've lost a significant amount of weight. So they're consuming a lot of calories, and a lot of those calories are in the form of carbohydrates and glucose, because they just feel this urge to consume that. And because the insulin is not working properly, the kidney responds by saying, there's too much glucose in the bloodstream, let's try to get rid of it. And so you urinate out those glucose calories, and that causes, the medical term is an osmotic diuresis, but you're urinating out calories that you're consuming, so you're sort of in a relative starvation condition. And that's why people feel tired.
Now, you said, and I think this should get a lot of people's attention, is that you compared type 2 diabetes to the COVID epidemic. Now, maybe people aren't dying like they would from the COVID virus, but I think you're talking about numbers and how many people, as you just described, that aren't even aware that they may have type 2 diabetes. How did we get to this point? I mean, is type 2 diabetes growing the number of cases because people we do have this obesity and weight problem?
Yes. So look, it's a great question. So actually, diabetes is the sixth leading cause of death in the United States today. And consider this. In 1960, the incidence of type 2 diabetes in America was 1% of the population. We're now at 10% plus, right? So the genetics hasn't changed at all in that period of time. What has changed is the lifestyle, right? So you can just correlate that incredibly well with the increase in weight. So the percentage of Americans who are overweight or obese is 50 to 60%. And we live in an automated society. There are some people that say that we can track the increase in diabetes and obesity with the advent of television in the United States of America. It's quite remarkable. And not only is it the sixth leading cause of death, it's the number one cause of kidney failure, blindness, amputations, and it's strongly associated with cardiovascular disease. And that's the number one cause of death in people with type 2 diabetes, and it's what we really try to prevent and guard against.
See, again, probably our audience just learned something because they think, oh, type 2 diabetes, nowhere near as serious as type 1 diabetes. What you just described is that it can actually lead to death.
Absolutely, that's right. And in fact, in the studies that we're doing now, type 1 diabetics, really, they have a deficiency in a hormone. If that hormone's replaced and the patients have very good glycemic control, they do incredibly well. And in fact, the morbidity and mortality in people with type 1 diabetes is now getting very close to the normal population, which is really great news. So type 2 diabetes is associated with a lot of other medical problems. We sort of categorize those as a group as the metabolic syndrome, and they're associated, or the linchpin behind them is insulin resistance, but that comes with high blood pressure, high cholesterol, et cetera, right? So you put all those things together, and if they're not well controlled, that can lead to a really increased risk of cardiovascular disease.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking about diabetes 100 years after insulin was discovered in 1921 by a group of Canadian scientists. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So let's talk a little bit about type 1 diabetes. 1.6 million Americans living with type 1 diabetes. We have come a long way from 1921 when insulin was discovered in Toronto. Diabetes at that time, now we've known about it for, medical science has known about it for hundreds of years, if not thousands of years. Most of the time they knew about it because of when people urinated, they could tell a difference, and that's how often it was tested. But that in 1921, this was a game changer. Diabetes, type 1 diabetes, was a death sentence. People weren't expected to live very long after it was determined that they had diabetes. So talk about, you know, we're using the term insulin kind of interchangeably in that the body produces insulin, but what we're talking about here is the discovery of insulin that can replace that insulin.
So that's right, Scott. So in the case of folks with type 1 diabetes, and this is the diabetes that's often associated with juvenile onset. It used to be called juvenile onset diabetes, but we now have seen, you know, adults in their 70s and 80s that actually get type 1 diabetes. But you're exactly right. People have known about diabetes for centuries, actually. And when you had type 1 diabetes back in the 1920s, you survived weeks or months. And, you know, Leonard Thompson was the first person. He was a 14-year-old boy who was treated with the first version. And it was a crude version that was derived from actually dog pancreases that were ground up and isolated and injected. And Leonard Thompson lived to be, I think, 35 years old. He died of pneumonia. When I am teaching our medical students about type 1 diabetes, I show them a photograph of another young boy who was only 3 years old, and he's being held by his mother. He's 3 years old, and he weighs 15 pounds. Now, a five-month-old should weigh 15 pounds. This boy is starving to death. You can see all the bones on his chest. And the treatment back then, Scott, for type 1 diabetes was caloric restriction. Now, this boy was urinating out all of his calories. He was literally starving to death. And the only treatment to prolong his life was to withdraw his calories. He got his injection of insulin in January, and in February, the next month, he weighed 30 pounds and looked like a perfectly normal boy. And it's funny because in endocrinology, we treat people with hormone deficiencies. One of those deficiencies sometimes can be growth hormone. And there are a lot of people who think that insulin was probably not named properly, and it really should be called growth hormone, because we cannot grow and we cannot sustain our weight without insulin. So this was really one of the great translational research experiments ever, and just saved the lives of so many people. You know, Teddy Ryder was one of the first to get insulin and was one of the first people to live for 70 years with type 1 diabetes. And you're exactly right about the technology today. We now have insulin pumps and sensors for folks that talk to each other. So it's almost like a hybrid closed loop. So the patients have to do very little, and we can maintain their blood sugars at very close to a normal range. And we expect that those people are never going to get complications from type 1 diabetes, like blindness, kidney disease, heart disease, et cetera, and they're going to live normal lives. So, you know, over the course of about 100 years, we've really transformed the care of type 1 diabetes, and there's much more to come.
You know, just as an observer, it appears that we have made so many advances in the treatment of diabetes. I'm thinking back to, in fact, we're going to be talking with a gentleman in a few minutes who has lived his whole life trying to overcome what he was told that diabetics shouldn't be doing. You're at Penn, Philadelphia Flyer Hall of Fame hockey player Bobby Clark was drafted by the Flyers in 1969. He was a diabetic. Many people thought that, you know, he has diabetes. There's no way he'll have the energy and the strength to play a professional sport like he did. But it just goes to show that how far we have come in treating diabetes, doesn't it?
Absolutely, Scott. And so that's so interesting that you mentioned Bobby Clark, because nobody really understood diabetes. It was a huge risk. Bobby Clark was passed over by every team in the NHL, and some of them twice, right? He was taken in the second round, although he was thought to be, you know, the best player out there. And interestingly, at the time that Bobby Clark was being treated for type 1 diabetes, we were not using human insulin or human insulin analogs, which are the insulins that we use today, which are very precise, much more physiologic. Bobby Clark was getting animal-derived insulins from beef and pork. And even Banting and Best had gone to slaughterhouses because they were running out of the dogs that they used to isolate insulin. And so they were the first people who really derived those insulins. And they had a lot of impurities in them. And the thing that I think really saved Bobby Clark was that he was an athlete, right? So exercise actually sensitizes insulin and makes insulin work better. And it's an interesting thing that when I was a boy, I was a big hockey fan and fan of the Flyers. And I read about Bobby Clark, and I saw that the trainers on the bench were feeding Bobby Clark Coca-Cola and Hershey bars. And I remember thinking to myself, what a wonderful disease to have, right? Your treatment is Hershey bars and Coca-Cola. But the problem was he had this long-acting sort of erratic insulin, and he was a guy who worked incredibly hard. He was killing penalties. He was on the power play. He was out there all the time, and that sensitized that insulin and made his sugars drop, right? And that is a real side effect of insulin, and often it plagues a lot of patients, right? So we have to sort of thread this needle and fine-tune things so that we can allow our patients to be spontaneous, to exercise, do the things that they want to do without the adverse consequence of hypoglycemia. But Bobby Clark, as far as I know, is doing incredibly well. I see photographs of him. And again, I really think that his active lifestyle is the thing that's helped him more than any other thing.
What are some of the risk factors of diabetes? For diabetes,
so in type 2 diabetes, there are a lot of risk factors, right? So if you are part of an ethnic minority group, if you're South Asian, if you're a person of color in this country, if you're Hispanic in ethnicity, American Indian, those are risk factors for type 2 diabetes. So, you know, there are lots of genes that predispose us to type 2 diabetes, and there are actually several different variations of type 2 diabetes that present slightly different ways and have different manifestations. But those are risks. If you have a strong family history of diabetes, if you were pregnant and developed diabetes during your pregnancy, that really increases your risk. It's interesting that 1 in 3 Americans today will develop diabetes in their lifetime. And if you are a Hispanic woman, your risk of diabetes is about 50% in the United States today.
Wow. I have a question from a listener who wants to know, I experienced low blood sugar a few hours after eating carbohydrates, including an oatmeal breakfast, which is supposed to be healthy. I'm not overweight, and I'm very careful what I eat. Do I have metabolic disorder or a propensity for diabetes?
So likely you don't. However you could, right? So sometimes we discover diabetes because someone has a low sugar after they eat a lot of carbohydrates. And that's because they have a blunted, delayed insulin response, right? So they consume the calories get absorbed, et cetera. And then the insulin sort of hanging out in the body, in the bloodstream, and it makes the sugar drop. That the person that's calling in probably doesn't have frank hypo or low blood sugar. Your glucose has to be below 45 in order to have that. What the patient may have is something called sort of meal-induced hypoglycemia. And it's not really technically a low sugar. It's a sensation that your sugar has dropped a little low for you. Sometimes that can happen if you've been exercising just prior or after your meal because you, again, have sensitized your insulin a little bit. And so, you know, it's just a relative drop in your blood sugar. We actually call it reactive hypoglycemia, but it's not technically hypoglycemia.
So we've talked a lot about some of the risk factors and what has led to the number of cases of diabetes. What can be done? Is there anything that can be done to reduce the risk of diabetes?
Absolutely. So we have a lot of great data on this, Scott. We have a study called the Diabetes Prevention Program, which showed us that if you were predisposed, if you were somebody who was at higher risk, right, someone who maybe had gestational diabetes, diabetes in pregnancy, or you're overweight and you have a strong family history, simply losing 5 to 7% of your weight. So if you weigh, you know, 200 pounds, that's really not a lot of weight. That's, you know, 10 to 14 pounds, which most people can do. And in addition to the weight loss, if you just exercise for 150 minutes a week, brisk walking, you know, 30 minutes a day, 5 times a week, that can dramatically reduce your risk of developing type 2 diabetes by 58%, which is really, I think, a staggering number. Very important that if you are at risk, that you get screened on a regular basis, starting at the age of 30 by your primary care doctor, and, you know, every year or two after that. And again, it's really adopting a healthy lifestyle. And that's a challenge for a lot of folks today. In the United States, people work really hard. There are a lot of families where both spouses have full-time jobs. So it's hard to kind of fit in, you know, healthy cooking from home and making time to be active, you know? So a lot of things I'll tell my patients is, look, if you're taking the bus to work every day, just get off three or four stops in advance, as long as it's a beautiful day like it is today, and walk. We have a lot of folks who have walking teams at work, and at lunch, they all go out for a walk together. There's data that suggests that that is incredibly impactful and healthy for you, right? So there are a lot of little things that you can do. So if you're somebody who's 30 years old and you have a strong family history of type 2 diabetes, there's no reason that you can't avoid that. You absolutely can.
Dr. Mark Schuette, very interesting. Dr. Schuette is the medical director of the Penn Rodabaugh Diabetes Center at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman Center for Advanced Medicine. Dr. Schuette, thank you very much for being with us today.
It was a pleasure to be with you, Scott, and your audience. Thanks so much.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.
Richard Humphreys was diagnosed with diabetes when he was 14 years old. Living with diabetes and overcoming diabetes to live a normal life has been one of the defining aspects of his life. Rich Humphreys has written a book that says a lot about him, Sweet Life, Seven Unexpected Blessings of Living with Diabetes. He's now 78. He's making an attempt to hike from Lancaster to a camp in Ohio. It's the oldest camp for children living with diabetes, and Humphreys is hoping to raise money for the camp where he was a counselor years ago. Richard Humphreys, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Scott. I do enjoy listening to Smart Talk pretty regularly, and it's good to be on your program. I will say that you say you're broadcasting from your home studio, and I'm broadcasting from my gnome studio. Yep. And I have a nature trail here, Nome countryside. It all came about because of diabetes. I've been doing Nome countryside for 42 years. I was an art teacher. I love teaching art. And I woke up in 1980 before there was any way to check your blood sugar. And I had a massive hemorrhage in my right eye that took my vision for a year, but Ken Messner, who is an ophthalmologist, and he treated me successfully with tens of thousands of laser burns. And so I had spent time in Iceland. I was fortunate to be able to do a lot of traveling. And in Iceland, they have rerouted roads because of the little people, the elementals. And I spent a lot of time in Denmark, where the older folks have sincere beliefs in the little people. And in nearly in every indigenous culture in the world, there are stories and legends of little people. So I do have a beautiful property, and I thought, well, I have a nature trail here, and I'll take people out in the woods looking for signs of the little people. And as you might imagine, about 95% of my friends told me I was crazy, which I certainly understand. But 3 years later, I was seeing 6,000 people a year here. And it's not about looking for gnomes exactly. It's about having people love the forest environment and having children love the forest. Because when you love something, you want to take care of it.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because as I said in my introduction, about living a normal life with diabetes, that probably is not a good way to describe the life that you have lived as the gnome man. How did diabetes come to be a major part of your life? And I'm not just talking about your health, but you use diabetes to live your life. in and help other people and to befriend other people. How did diabetes come to define what you do?
Well, that's my dog Riley because my son just came down. Okay, so Scott, I love people, and I don't know exactly how to answer your question. I look at diabetes as a blessing. It has encouraged me to do so many things I otherwise wouldn't have done. I had a goal to make a trip around the world by the time I was 33. I did that. I rode my mom sent my 10-speed bicycle to Corvallis, Oregon, and I rode my bicycle back across America. I made that trip without any way to check my blood sugar. I'm a little in awe of that now. I did prick my finger to get blood for 40 years. Now I'm using this Libre sensor. I have the sensor on my arm, and then I just scan that with this little meter, and it reads out my blood sugar. I just checked before I talked with you, and my blood sugar was 156. I wanted to make sure that my blood sugar wasn't low, because when your blood sugars are low, it interferes with your thinking process, and I didn't want to blunder around.
Well, that's a good thing, you know. Tell me about Camp Homi Dakota.
Oh, yes. Well, Camp Homi Dakota dramatically influenced my life. It has influenced the life of thousands of children living with diabetes. I first went to Camp Homi Dakota as a program director from 1969 till 1973. Then I went back as the director from 1991 to 2007. I saw children's lives dramatically change. I'll tell you about one boy, Jacob. He was 8 years old when he came to camp. Just the sweetest little boy. And, of course, he was diagnosed with diabetes at eight. And remained a camper until he was able to be a CIT, a counselor in training. Then he became a counselor. And then Jacob went to college, and he had difficulty because he had a continuously feeding insulin pump. And he was supposed to be wakened up at 8 o'clock in the morning, and his classmates didn't awaken him. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Jacob was awakened. He had brain damage. He had to learn his ABCs again. He had to learn how to count again. I asked Jacob if he could be standing underneath the statue of Frederick Banting when I get to Camp Homi Dakota. This is a 380-mile walk, which I did when I was 65. I'm walking back there. I'm leaving this Sunday. I'm so excited about it. And I can't wait to see Jacob when I walk into the camp. I told Jacob I was going to give him a big hug. And I can't imagine going through what Jacob has gone through. But what a wonderful young man.
Well, from what I understand, you are a legend at Camp Homi Dakota, and that there probably are lots of young people like Jacob that you've had an influence on over the years. As you mentioned, you're walking 380 miles starting on Sunday, and walking has been a big part of your life. But you're raising money for the camp with your walk. And the camp is in Ohio, by the way. So tell us how you're raising money and what that money will go for.
Okay, well, I'm raising money for two reasons. One is the camp, which and we have children there from all over the world, really. And I'm also raising money. My son Case is an art teacher in Solanco, and Case is making a sound and sculpture garden here at Nome Countryside. And so the monies will be going toward the camp and the sculpture garden. When I walked home, when I was 65, I raised $7,000. But you can go to Camp Homitakota, Homitakoda, which in Sioux means welcome my friend. And that camp was started by a Cleveland doctor, he has a great legacy there. I might be a legend in my own mind, but that's about it.
Well, tell me a little bit about the camp and what helps the children with diabetes. I mean, one of the things I understand is that, I talked to Dr. Shuda earlier about those who are diagnosed with diabetes being told they can't do certain things. But from what I understand at the camp, the kids are encouraged to do things that they're told that they can't do.
That's exactly right, and I do appreciate your questions. And one of the things I started when I was there, they're no longer doing it because of the additional traffic on the highways, but I did a 14-mile hike with the campers, and most of the staff are diabetic, so they all know about what to look for when a child's blood sugar is too low or too high. And the camp, what happens is children see other children their age taking insulin and living with diabetes. I believe that's the most important part of the camp, that they are not alone. I was 14 when I contracted diabetes. I thought I was the only person in the world with diabetes. And when my blood sugars at school would be low or high, and I was very shy, and I didn't like to draw attention to myself. And but the overriding factor is the children see they're not alone living with this disease. And by the way, we encourage so many. We have a ropes course at Camp Homitakoda. So there's a log that you walk across that's 40 feet off the ground. And everybody, of course, is carabined in. And the ropes course is run well. There's a lake there. And an Olympic-sized swimming pool, and we have various activities so children know they're not that different from other children, but of course there are differences.
Richard Humphreys, want to congratulate you on the work that you do at home with the Nome Trail and the walk that you're making on starting on Sunday, 380 miles to Ohio. Richard Humphreys, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Scott, and maybe sometime you can come down and look for some gnomes with us.
You may be
able to see them.
I will do that. Thank you very much. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. The restaurant business has always been tough. There are long hours, staffing challenges, and then out of nowhere, a pandemic hits. Finding trained and willing staff to work in local high-end restaurants and even fast food outlets is proving difficult today. Two area organizations are taking the challenge in stride and remaining focused on a partnership that benefits both of them. The Hotel Hershey at Hershey Entertainment and Resorts Company has teamed up with the Lebanon County Career and Technology Center to train and educate the next generation of culinary and pastry apprentices. Joining us, Chef Nicholas Arnold, Executive Chef at Hotel Hershey, Chef Robert Coral, Chef Instructor with the Lebanon County Career and Technology Center, and Connor Woodburn, who is a culinary apprentice with the Lebanon County Career and Technology Center. Welcome to the program. Before we talk about the particulars of your relationship, Chef Arnold, I want to ask you, apprentice is something that we have heard throughout history. It is something that happens today, but not as much today as it did 100 or 200 years ago. How is a chef apprentice used at Hotel Hershey? What is a chef apprentice?
Well, a chef apprentice is a very vital educational tool, and to be able to really learn through the ranks from other chefs. So one would become, of course, a student, and most of the training the student will, of course, or a student apprentice will get is then to be hands-on training so that you can learn from others. And it really kind of weaves the fabric going back from those who then I learned from, et cetera. So an apprentice is used in a rotational way through all of Hershey Entertainments and Resorts at the Lodge, at the Country Club, and at the Hotel Hershey, so that they can get multivariate skills, whether it's quick order, fine dining, or just some of the basics in soup, sauces, and classic stocks and butchery.
So this is not something new for the Hotel Hershey and in the kitchen in particular, getting that hands-on training rather than just getting an education and hiring someone who was directly out of school with that education. Talk about this partnership, though, this relationship. How did it develop a relationship between the Hotel Hershey and the Lebanon County Career and Technology Center?
Well, it really dates back some time, really from kind of all of our mentors on the call. I know that's one of our longest apprentices. He's been here now 41 years. He was actually the chef that I worked under many years ago, whose name was Hans Schadler, actually helped to graduate him and test him on his final practical. So not only learning from those people, my mentors, and then kind of just continuing to pass that down through generation to generation. I know that Chef Coral, he was also an apprentice here, and now he of course, teaches and helps to lead the culinary program at LCCTC. So it continues to kind of weave the fabric of handing off professionalism and techniques so that it's not a lost art.
Chef Coral, let's talk about that. What are you, as an educator, what are you looking for in this relationship with the hotel?
Well, thanks for having us on today, Scott. We appreciate it. But it's been... this has been a long journey, so to speak. The apprenticeship at the hotel has a rich history, as Chef Arnold was speaking about. It's actually started in 1973, and I came there in 1985 to do my apprenticeship as well, and then wound up staying there 9.5 years and got to see many apprentices come through the hotel in my time there as well. And so when I finally came down here to the Career and Technology Center, that's when Chef Heffley and I, who works here with me, he was an apprentice as well. And we decided that we wanted to, start an avenue that we could have students go from here and then just, parlay right into the hotel. So, we worked on that for many years with the former executive chefs at the hotel. And all of them gave us little bits and pieces to get it together. We started the apprenticeship, in the fall of 2017 and got through Chef Gladys, who was at the hotel at the time. He helped us get it started and get it launched. So the apprenticeship, we felt, was going to be something that gave students another option. We're all about options, giving students different avenues to be successful in their careers. And the hotel found that it was easy to take a student and bring them on part-time, have them work there, mainly from the end of October through the new year. And then if they felt that that student was going to, you know, make an impact there at the hotel, then they would ask them to come on. And then the student would be there through the summer, basically, you know, fine tuning themselves. And then that next fall, then they would start as an apprentice. And so what the we do with the hotel is we have a 4,000 hour program where the apprentices are going to do 4,000 hours hands-on through the HE&R properties, and then they'll do about 420 hours of instructional time down here at the CTC with us. So with all that together, that gives the student, you know, we're certified through the Department of Labor here in Pennsylvania for apprenticeship. So we have that, and we are also partnered with the American Culinary Federation for certification if the student wishes to do that as well. Also, we are partnered with HAC for students then to move on and get a substantial cut in getting their associate's degree in hospitality management. So it is a wonderful avenue for students if they don't feel like they want to go into, you know, more post-secondary schooling, which it is in a way, but it's more hands-on. So I think a lot of students, why they come to the CTC is because they like hands-on.
Hmm. You know, so there is a tradition that is there and a history between the technology school and Hotel Hershey. You know, just as an outside observer, I would think, Chef Coral, that for students, you know, having the opportunity to go to Hotel Hershey, you know, one of the most respected, prestigious restaurants in our well, not just central Pennsylvania, but probably on the east coast of the United States, in the whole country. I mean, that seems to me that would provide some real motivation for your students to say, you know, here's something I'd like to do.
Yeah, and that's true. And the amazing thing is how many of them never have been in the hotel. So we always encourage them to go up and look at it. And when they do get in their tours and chefs take them around, they come back and they're like, wow, I didn't know it was like that. And I'm like, yeah, it is something. And I think, you know, and we go back to, as Chef Arnold was talking about, Hans Schadler, I got to work with him. I also, my mentor and the gentleman that did start the apprenticeship back in the 70s was Hans Hotley. And he was a Swiss-born chef, you know, worked in Europe and brought that European-style apprenticeship over here. And I think that the students that we have here, we are training them as almost like a pre-apprenticeship, getting them ready to go into the apprenticeship. And, you know, Chef Arnold is a dynamic guy, and we're looking at different things and different ways of bringing back a lot of the things that we used to do as apprentices with meat fab. And he's talking about, you know, more extensive garmage work, which is cold side, doing pâtés, terrines, preserving foods and things of that nature. So all of those together, I don't think a student would get bored at all, you know, going this route, you know, for their career choice. There's no doubt about it.
It doesn't sound that way. If you're just tuning in, during this portion of the program, we're talking about an apprenticeship, a program that's been going on now for some time, but probably what a lot of other industries could model after. And that is the partnership or relationship between the Hotel Hershey at Hershey Entertainment and Resorts Company and the Lebanon County Career and Technology Center. Our guest, Chef Nicholas Arnold, the executive chef at Hotel Hershey. Chef Robert Coral, chef instructor with the Lebanon County Career and Technology Center. I'm going to be joined by Connor Woodburn, who is a culinary apprentice, in just a moment. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let me bring Connor Woodburn into our conversation now. Connor, thanks for being with us today. You are a culinary apprentice. Tell us a little bit about your experiences so far.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Coming into this program, I mean, straight off the bat, Hershey apprenticeship, there's no other one around here like that. There's no apprenticeship that you go through three different properties and multiple different restaurants, multiple different cuisines, and working with multiple different sous chefs. Like, it all goes back to the experience and the hands-on. Like, you just can't beat it. I mean, you're constantly learning new things just in the working part, and then you go to the schooling part, and then you're learning more stuff there. So you're really getting the book experience and then all of your hands-on experience through this.
All right, so what's your specialty, Connor?
My specialty? I love grilling. Anything on the grill, I love doing.
Well, you could do that in your backyard. What's the difference between doing grilling in your backyard? I'm sure there's a big one. And grilling at Hotel Hershey.
I mean, just the products that we get in are probably the best products you'll get around here. So being able to work with them definitely is a very nice opportunity. And all the equipment is very nice, too. Definitely not your backyard equipment.
Yeah, I joke with you a little bit there. But so what's your goal? What do you want to do career-wise with this?
I mean, I chose this apprenticeship course over a four-year program just because I believed getting like the hands-on experience will definitely pursue my career, and I want to be able to work in like fine dining restaurants. And then, I mean, the end goal is always to be a chef of either your own restaurant or one that you've worked in before. So definitely my goal is to be a chef at the end of this.
What would your own restaurant be called?
Oh, man.
I just wondered if you thought about that.
I have not. I'm sorry.
All right. Okay. Well, there's something for you to think about. I put you on the spot with that one. We have an email here from Michael who says, apprenticeship is a comprehensive, cost-effective way to learn a trade and excel. Our local culinarians have limited choices for a solid culinary education at a post-secondary level, but the Lebanon County Career and Technology Center and their instructors, in conjunction with the chefs and pastry chefs at the Hotel Hershey, will lay an excellent foundation for them. More food service operations should look at this model as well. Chef Arnold, let me ask you about that. I mean, in response to what our listener had to say there, I mean, I talked about, you know, probably what people think about when they hear the word apprentice, but it does seem like a way that you kind of said it yourself earlier, that students can get that hands-on training, but at the same time, they are doing valuable work for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's not only a thing of the past, but it's definitely the wave of the future. I can tell you from my own experience, I had to go, grew up in a small town in Wisconsin, and I had to really go outside of my backyard, very similar to Connor, to try to find chefs who would be able to have that sort of cuisine. Of course, when I was going to culinary school, you still had to take a semester-long class on how to use the internet, you know, back in 1995. And so you didn't really have the books and all of the technology that was there. And so my question always was, how do you become a chef? And I guess I kept asking that over and over and over again. And I guess that, you know, working from the American Club for my mentor, and then working, and his name was Reese Lewis. He was the executive chef of the American Club. Hans Schadler was his mentor, and so then I went to work at the Keneal Bay Resort in St. John, and ended up becoming the chef garmager at the age of 23. And so it was only through the people that I knew, the coming in early, staying late, and really taking notes on what other people did, and then repeating the practice, and then also working with my schooling to learn what I didn't know. And so of course there's a lot more educational opportunities available, just, you know, having the internet these days, of course. And back then, you know, to find a cookbook was kind of hard, and information was limited. So it's one of those things, is that being that we're in a world that just provides a simple recipe and it provides success, I think that, and I would say that probably Chef Coral could assimilate it along with Connor, is that, you know, to fail often is sometimes to make something wrong over and over and over again, and then finally getting in that one right way, that really locks it in, you know. And we tell all of our externs, apprentices, and co-ops, make a new mistake every day, and because that's really the learning process versus handing it on a plate to somebody. So we value it at a high level, not only personally but professionally.
Some great life lessons, what you just said. And again, I think it's something that maybe it is the way of the future as well. Chef Nicholas Arnold, executive chef at Hotel Hershey, Chef Robert Coral, chef instructor with Lebanon County Career and Technology Center, and Connor Woodburn, who one day will have a restaurant. He just doesn't have a name yet. Connor Woodburn, thank all three of you for being with us today. And have yourself a great day. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.